I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, October 11th. Central to President Biden's Build Back Better or Reconciliation Plan, as it's often called, is a new model and much more money for childcare in the United States. A look around the world shows what an outlier the U.S. is. Each year, the United States spends only about $500 per child on early child care. That number in other wealthy countries, on average, is $14,000 per year. And it's not just those Scandinavian countries, right? People always point to as examples of governments that promote and prioritize the well-being of their citizens. We're talking about countries like Slovenia, which spends 22 times more than the United States on early childhood care, Lithuania, and Chile, which spend 16 to 17 times as much as the U.S. on child care, according to recent reporting. But as Congress negotiates the details of the reconciliation package, proposals for increased child care spending are likely to meet the chopping block. So with me now to talk about the scarcity of child care funding in this country is Bryce Covert, an independent journalist who covers the economy. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, The Nation, and elsewhere. And yes, this is the same Bryce Covert who tweeted yesterday, "Sure, a Pulitzer would be nice, but I just got my two-year-old to willingly and happily eat kale." So that's basically the same thing. So Bryce, congratulations on your faux Pulitzer for toddler taste bud cultivation, and welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me.
So, Bryce, $500 per year on early child care, according to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, that international group, and the Hamilton Project. In practice, what does that look like, and where does that place us in a global context?
Sure. Well, first, as you pointed out, it makes us a huge outlier, particularly when you compare us to other developed countries. Like you said, it's not just Nordic countries, the ones that we think of as doing a really good job here, Norway, Denmark. It's all sorts of countries. Like you said, Slovenia, Australia, Germany, places that have booming economies. And we just do so little by comparison. What that looks like for the typical family, if you are a low-income family, you might be able to get child care subsidies from the federal government or your state government. To be honest, though, those even don't reach that many people. They're hard to get. They're hard to hold on to. There's a lot of hoops you have to jump through. There's also Head Start and early Head Start for low-income families. If you are above those income cutoffs, basically what you get is a tax credit once a year that's a tiny fraction of what you're likely paying if you have a child in either a child care center or a preschool.
And just one local stat as a conversation starter, NJ.com has an article over the weekend that says New Jersey families would save $27,000 a year on child care under the Biden spending bill. That's the headline of that. And of course, it's going to be different for different families. But in the context of your reporting, how do you hear a stat like that from NJ.com, which, you know, for those of you who don't know, is the same basically as the Star Ledger, $27,000 a year savings for the average New Jersey family? What does that mean? Who does that apply to, if you can put it in the context of what you see nationally?
Well, it gets to the fact that if Congress passes something like what they've been discussing in the Build Back Better bill or the reconciliation bill, it would just be a huge transformation of the way we go about this. The number is probably particularly high in a place like New Jersey because the costs are probably pretty high there. The costs of childcare range quite a lot across the country, but they can very easily enter the tens of thousands of dollars a year. They often rival college costs, to give you a sense of what parents are facing. And this plan, if it were to become reality for many families, not all families, but many families, it would cap their costs at 7% of their income. And then, and the impact that could have on those families that are eligible would just be pretty revolutionary. We just have not ever extended that kind of help for families trying to pay child care costs in this country before.
Yeah, and for more context, here's another article from just over the weekend. This was in the New York Times with the headline, "When Child Care Costs Twice as Much as the Mortgage." and it's Dateline Greensboro, North Carolina. It says, to understand the problems Democrats hope to solve with their supersized plan to make childcare better and more affordable, consider this small southern city where many parents spend more for care than they do for mortgages, yet teachers get paid like fast food workers, and centers cannot hire enough staff. So, wow. And Bryce, that brings in another couple of elements, which is teacher pay and pay for other child care workers who are not teachers per se, and a worker shortage in this area, yes?
Yes. Basically, the whole system is broken, if you can even call it a system. And this was true before the pandemic, although, of course, we've really seen it highlighted in the pandemic during this crisis. Basically, we have a private system where parents are on the hook to find and cover the cost of child care. But it's not the kind of business where there's a lot of cost efficiencies. It just costs a lot of money to provide quality care, to have enough teachers to keep kids safe, to buy the food they need, to pay rent for a location. And so it's just a place where the costs are high. And if the government isn't stepping in the middle to make sure that quality is covered, that teachers are paid well, that there are good standards, it's just not working for either side of the equation. It doesn't work for the teachers and the providers. It doesn't work for the parents. And that's where the way it looks all the way across the country, for the most part, outside of places that have done universal preschool or heavy subsidies.
And here's another news from the last few days stat that exemplifies it when you say it doesn't work for parents. Yeah, and it doesn't work for some parents more than it doesn't work for other parents. Last week's jobs report showed that while men gained 220,000 jobs in September nationwide, women lost 26,000. And of course, women in this country bear the brunt of childcare. They make up the vast majority of staff members at daycares. Is that why many are calling this period that we're in a she session?
Yeah, I think we don't quite know exactly what happened last month. It was 1 month of data, but it looks a lot like what happened last September when schools were not fully open and a lot of child cares are still closed. At the beginning of this year, about a third were still closed. And parents and families don't have options. When we say parents, you're right to point out often it's mothers who are feeling the effects of child care scarcity and child care unaffordability. And again, this was true pre-pandemic. We know that it has a huge impact on mothers' ability to work outside the home if they are able to find and afford child care. And right now, it's even harder to do those things. I think we are at risk of seeing more women drop out again, or at least cut back again to try to make this whole situation work.
And with the uncertainty of kids going back to school and in person this fall, but not knowing if there are going to be quarantine periods after exposures, some parent has to be ready to receive those kids. And it looks like that's contributing to keeping a lot of women out or even pushing them out of the workforce from outside the home at this particular point in time this fall. Let's take a phone call from someone who says she has raised kids in three different countries. And that is Karen in Summit, New Jersey. Karen, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine.
Great. Yeah, I raised, this was a while ago, though, so some of this might be a little bit dated. But yeah, I had my first in Paris, then moved to London, and then came into New York. And I must say that, you know, the difference in the systems was amazing. And London was more like here, where there really wasn't a lot of support and subsidized daycare. So a lot of the women were like the she recession, you know, dropping out of work. I had friends who were lawyers and doctors who had stepped out of work because childcare was so expensive, and then moved back to Paris where childcare is subsidized. It's unbelievably high quality. You get a spot. It's a sliding scale, so everybody can afford it. If you don't make as much as your neighbor, you can still afford it. Great care. It goes till 7 p.m. at night, so you can pick up your kids after work. And then they also have, you know, universal nursery. So your kids start school between the ages of 2.5 and 3. So again, they're in school, high quality. You never have to worry about it, and it doesn't break the bank. Came to America, and it was more like London. I think we were spending easily a quarter of my salary on childcare, if not more. And it was not anywhere near as good quality as what I had had in France, and it goes until the age of, you know, five, until your child can get into kindergarten, if you're lucky enough to have kindergarten.
Thank you for your call. Yep. I really appreciate it. So what would the Biden agenda actually change with respect to child care in the United States? And if there are many, many, many things, maybe you could give us a few of the big headline things, you know, beyond just spending. Listeners to this show know that I want to scream when other people just refer to it as the $3.5 trillion spending bill, rather than centering what the bill would do. And then, of course, we have to talk about how much it costs and how to pay for it and how much is worth it and all of that stuff. It's not a spending bill. It's a child care bill and an elder care bill and a climate change prevention bill. And then we can talk about the money. So with respect to child care, how much would it bring a revolution?
So I just have to say that we don't know for exact sure what it would do, because that's all in flux a little bit. But the plan that's passed out of a House committee basically looks like a plan that was put forward by Senators Patty Murray and Bobby Scott, which would cap the costs at 7% of income for families up to a certain threshold. So they have it at twice a state's median income. Those families just would not pay more than that, and the government would step in and cover the rest of the cost. For families who are low income, the care would be totally free. And that's for young kids. When the kids reach ages 3 and 4, it would institute universal preschool. And that would be free for all and open to all. The plan also comes with money to make sure that providers are paid adequately, fairly, and also some money to help providers increase their quality, because quality is a real issue across the country. There has been sort of a fight inside the party as to whether to cap the subsidies or to make them universal. I don't know exactly where that's going to land. The plan put forward by Senator Elizabeth Warren looks similar to this, but it would offer that 7% cap to all families. So it would be a universally available subsidy. It would also be an entitlement, which means that if you qualify, you get the money, which is a little bit different than how it works right now. So it would be a huge influx of money into this sector, into families' pockets, to help cover this cost. And it would try to at least prod along some improvements in the way that we do child care and early education.
Jill in Jersey City has a story from Iceland, I think. Jill, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. So when my son, who's now 12, was 2, we moved to Iceland for 6 months, and he wasn't able to get, you had to get the social security number before you could register. There was a 6-month waiting list. We were only there for 6 months. So he wasn't able to get into childcare, but people were shocked that he was not in daycare. Because it's considered a social good for toddlers to socialize together and learn developmentally together. And so we were considered bad parents because he was not in daycare and at 2 years old.
And do you happen to know the funding system over there or anything about it?
Yes, they had recently passed, but they both provide parental leave, both for both parents, but they also pay for child care. It's publicly paid for at 2 years old. So until they start school at 6.
Jill, despite your being a bad parent, kidding. Thank you very much for sharing for sharing that story about your experience in Iceland. And Evie, or is it Evie, in Orlando? You're on WNYC. Hello from New York.
Hi, Brian. Good to talk to you.
So you have a story from Bulgaria?
Yeah, I was born in Bulgaria and lived there until I was 6. My folks and I immigrated with my younger sister, who was 1 at the time. I started going to kindergarten there at 3 years old. You know, maternity leave, even in a formerly Eastern Bloc country, was really pretty good at the time. And so I was there until I was 6 when we moved and immigrated here to the United States. I was 6, my sister was 1. My parents had to take like alternating shifts because they couldn't afford childcare. So my mom would work during the day. My dad would work evening shifts for years until she could finally start kindergarten.
And what do you think is the lesson for the United States in terms of what can be adapted? And I think some of our listeners may be hearing your story and think, geez, even Bulgaria, which might reflect a stereotype about Bulgaria, but certainly it's not as wealthy a country as the United States.
Definitely not. I mean, it's just, it's a matter of principles, and I would love to see, you know, now as an adult starting my own family, like, I would love to see, you know, some sort of priority be given to early childhood education and what it takes to afford even now, especially now, I guess, what it takes to be able to afford to put a child through childcare is absolutely bonkers.
Absolutely. Evie, thank you so much. Let's keep going around the world with Mehdi in Nutley, New Jersey. Next, Mehdi, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What you got?
I have an experience with service in the Gulf area, Saudi Arabia and Emirates to be specific. This was years back. What they've done, they actually gave tax exempt to all child care providers, facilities, and also they gave tax credit to parents. And in addition to that, they have free meals to all children, regardless if they are in private child care facility or if they are in kindergarten. And this allowed the system to flourish and also for the private child care provider to hire qualified teachers. Some of them have PhDs and master degree for child care providing.
Mehdi, thank you very much. And I'll throw one more in here before we get a thought from our guest, economics reporter Bryce Covert. In Denmark, from what I've read, kids are guaranteed a spot in child care until age 10. Now, obviously, they're going to school before that, but this has to do with after school, because at 10, they start after school youth programs. And even if parents choose to hire a nanny instead, families receive help from the government to pay for that. So that's what I've read about part of Denmark's program. So Bryce, you're hearing these stories from around the world. It's something that a lot of Americans don't know about, where we fit in internationally with respect to child care, because, you know, we don't always hear the news from other countries.
I also think American families or Americans might not even know what our country does or doesn't do. I think there might be an assumption that we do more than is available. Take paid family leave, for example, which is part of this puzzle. Most people, I think that there's some sort of guarantee after you have a child that you'll get paid leave, but there isn't. People don't know how much it costs. People also don't know how little providers are paid until you are hit with it personally, and then you realize how much you're on the hook and how hard it is to find and how low the quality is in a lot of places. And then you hear these stories from around the world, and it just is so clear that it operates completely differently in so many other countries that are our peers.
What about the way child care workers are paid in other countries, if you're familiar? You know, we had a segment recently about the elder care part of the Build Back Better bill, and one of the provisions there is better pay for chronically low-paid home health aides. And I see that among the rich countries who outspend America on child care funding in general, the wages in the U.S. tend to be about $12 an hour, not even a living wage. At least that stat is in one of the articles that I read. How about pay for child care providers, especially for young children elsewhere? Are you familiar?
It's a good question, and I'm not super familiar with every country. I would guess that it probably varies quite a lot, but there are definitely some systems. I point back to France, I believe, as an example, where they're basically treated like teachers, and I think that's really the dividing line for us. We, in this country, really separate out child care and school when they're very similar. But if you go into child care or even preschool as a provider or a teacher, you can expect to be paid far less than a kindergarten teacher or up. And one of the things that Democrats have been talking about wanting to do with this bill is to try to create more parity. Because really, you're working just as hard if you're taking care of a four-year-old as a five-year-old, but that's just not the way the system works right now. And It's part of, you mentioned the employment scarcity issues, the workforce issues for providers that are particularly acute right now. It's really hard to hold on to people, particularly qualified people, if they're paid so little and then they can look to the school system and say, well, I can get so much more money doing something very similar there. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people leave this sector and head to the school system, which makes it really hard when you're trying to give quality care to little kids.
And I guess if there's an alternative to childcare provided in some way or made affordable in some way for most families, it seems it would have to be paid family leave. But the U.S. doesn't offer that either, and that's also in the Build Back Better bill. There are 9 American states, from what I've read, that have established statewide paid family leave programs. New York offers up to 12 weeks, for example, but many countries in Europe offer 14 months. So there's, you know, I don't know what to say, except there's part of the balancing act that I guess the Democrats are debating right now, right?
Absolutely. This is part of the whole puzzle, is whether you do paid leave as well and what that looks like. Democrats are talking about 12 weeks of leave as a minimum in their bill. But as you pointed out, most countries go far beyond that. And that's part of this system. If parents can be home for, let's say, the first year of their child's life, then they're not even thinking about childcare and preschool until their kid is older, and you're not trying to figure out where that kid should go and how it should be financed and how it should be made high quality. So, you know, if we're doing 12 weeks, that's a huge step, because we've never guaranteed paid family leave in this country before. But 12 weeks is also a pretty short window. Putting a 3-month-old in daycare is complicated. So, you know, it's all part of the same continuum, the same system.
And we will have to leave it there from now, listeners. Maybe now you know a little more about where the United States fits in globally with respect to child care. Thanks for your calls with stories from all over. My guest has been Bryce Covert, an independent journalist who covers the economy. She's a contributor at The Nation, and her work has also appeared in the New York Times, among other places. Bryce, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.